Hey, quick thing before we dive in. Are you a professional working in the country music industry? Because it is time to renew your membership to the Academy of Country Music. Not a member yet? All good. Now is the time to join. You can still do it. Academy members are among the most respected leaders in the industry and hold the right to vote on ACM awards. They also receive exclusive benefits, including monthly educational panels and invites to networking events, early access to tickets for Academy events, discounts for ACM partner events, regular industry data and insights, and so much more if you are interested in applying for membership or if you need to renew your membership. Visit acmcountry.com/membership. Again, that's acmcountry.com/membership. There's time to renew, but time is closing because all renewals are due October 15th. So don't delay. Guys, we're talking about the ACMs here, okay? I mean, this isn't like your Joe Schmo, whatever, or, you know, this is the ACMs. It's like, get on board. Come on. So I don't know what else to tell you. It's like, you got to do it. Okay, enough of that. Let's dive in.
The Zach Kuhn Show.
Okay, here we go. Episode 80, Ted Chapin on the podcast. First of all, 80 episodes, big deal. Let's get back to Ted. Ted is the former president of the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization. Now, look, if you're a songwriter, if you're interested in the American Songbook, doesn't get better than Rodgers and Hammerstein. Some of the most iconic shows were written by them. Shows like Cinderella, South Pacific, King and I, Oklahoma, Carousel. What a list. And, you know, we talk about a lot here. We talk about how these shows came together. We talk a little bit about the process of these two iconic songwriters. And, you know, it's Annie Get Your Gun's 75th anniversary. And Rodgers and Hammerstein did not write Annie Get Your Gun, but they were involved in a very interesting way. We talk all about it. Not our usual content here. We're going Broadway-themed musical theater. I love it, though. I'm so excited about this. Here we go. Episode 80, Ted Chapin. Let's dive in.
First of all, I'm trying to understand how you get the gig as the head of the R&H. You were not an expert on the subject when right. Mary Rodgers approached you for this gig. You're running the theater lab. How did you become a candidate for this gig?
How did I become a candidate for the gig of running Rodgers and Hammerstein? A very good question. I always loved the theater. I always wanted to be part of the theater. I knew I didn't want to be an actor. That was a very important thing to learn early on. And so I realized that being a production assistant, then assisting directors, was a good way to sort of get your foot in the door, or as Lin-Manuel Miranda likes to say, be in the room where it happens.
Where it happens.
Absolutely,
yes.
Absolutely. So that's basically what I did. It's eclectic, but it was an interesting group of things I was able to do. Mary Rodgers was a friend of my parents, and I met her at, you know, dinners, because my parents were of the generation where they gave dinner parties. And of course, I knew who she was because I fell in love with the Mad Show, and which was, you know, for my age group, the hippest show ever. So I always asked her stories and, you know, what was it like? And then Once Upon a Mattress, I didn't see, but I knew about. And, you know, so I always got along with Mary. I thought she was great. And when I ran the musical theater lab, the idea that got me that job was to recreate what I knew Mary had been involved with at Tamament in the Poconos, where they, in the 50s, the guy who ran entertainment there invited a bunch of young musical theater wannabes to create entertainment for the campers. And as she described it, you know, that they would do it over a weekend. And the first performance on Saturday night would be very dull because everybody who had gone for the week vacation had not scored. So they were sad and going home the next day, whereas the Sunday night performance were all the people coming in wanting to score, and they were ready. But I knew that they wrote original material, and that's also where Once Upon a Mattress came out of, that much I knew. So I thought, wouldn't it be fun to recreate that in the early 1980s, late 1970s? you know, just get a bunch of musical theater writers, get a director, get some performers, and just crank out material. So I went to Mary to ask her advice about it. And she then came, we did it for 6 weeks in a row, and she came to every one of them. So, and she was very smart, opinionated, but she really loved that I had pulled this program off. That, I believe, is why when Rogers died, and for the very first time, these two families had to figure out what to do, because when both Rogers and Hammerstein were alive, and then Rogers were alive, it was his office, you know, right. He had a lot of people there, but he was the boss. Now there was nobody. So I found out later that they had asked a couple of people who had a lot more experience than I did. And they had very fancy ideas of what the job was in terms of what it would pay. And they wanted to get pickup limousines and club memberships and stuff like that, which kind of freaked them out. So Mary said that she waited until she could raise her hand and say, what about, you know, Skylar and Betty's son, Ted? He makes creative things happen. So that's how I got the call from Mary. And, they didn't know what they wanted and I didn't know what the job was. But to your point, you know, I wasn't an expert in licensing, you know, classic musicals, right, or music publishing or.
So going back for a second, you frequently say that you didn't want to be like a director. You didn't want to be this. You didn't want to be that. You just want to be in the room where it happens.
Yeah.
Why was it being an expert in, or being stuck to one specific aspect? What about that idea did you not want?
I figured that the position that I would strive for was either a director or a producer, because those were the kind of roles that seemed to be interesting. And
sure,
assisting very good directors in my early year, I think made me realize that I didn't know that I could be as sort of British theatrical as John Dexter, who gave us Equus, nor could I work with actors as brilliantly as Alan Arkin did when he directed. So I think early on, I thought, I don't know that I could be that good a director. And then producing, when I worked for Alan Arkin, I actually did produce a show that was a big failure. It closed out of town. So it's like, even though those were the areas that I thought of, neither of them made me feel rampantly ambitious that I have to be a director or I have to be a producer. So I was kind of, you know, swinging with the punches and see where it led me, which in retrospect, turned out to be kind of the perfect situation for the Rogers and Hammerstein job to come to me and for it to work.
Okay, so you get the job. Mary Rogers gives you the job, right? And then,
well, no, Dorothy Rogers and Hammerstein give me the job.
Yes.
Make no mistake about that. Mary was not in charge then.
Yes, Dorothy. Yes, gives you the job. And then, how do you familiarize yourself with the material, or how do you become an expert in the material? And how do you learn what the job is?
Well, I think one of the luckiest things was that I had a learning curve, but also the families had a learning curve, because they'd never had the kind of responsibility that they now had to figure out what to do, how to manage these shows. Also, as you know, Rogers and Hammerstein turned out to be very good businessmen, and they right. went into that, you know, they established businesses to service their shows. So there was a music publishing part of it. There was the licensing part of it. So I just, you know, I mean, luckily what they said to me is why don't you take a year to learn the ropes? And then if we all like each other, then you can take over. So that's what I saw. It was great. I would just go around to people's offices and say, what do you do? What is this job? And I just ask a lot of questions, so that by the time we did like each other and they said, you know, it's time for you to take over if you want it, I felt confident that I knew the basic groundwork of what it was all about. There were many, many questions which continued throughout my entire time there. One thing was, when I got there, Yul Brynner was touring the country in a pretty tacky production of The King and I, but it was all about him. It was making money hand over fist.
Yeah.
And it actually came back to New York a second time. And I remember thinking, not sure that's the future of Rogers and Hammerstein. I mean, Julie Andrews could do a stage production of the Sound of Music if she wanted, because I don't think Mary Martin, even though she was around, I don't think people, you know, were that interested. But other than that, if that's the way Rogers and Hammerstein's shows are going to live on Broadway, it's going to be a very short run.
So, right. They specifically didn't want stars in the shows typically, right? Because
Some of their shows were written for stars. South Pacific was written for stars. Clearly, Sound and Music was written for stars. The other ones, King and I, of course, for Gertrude Lawrence. But otherwise, you know, they were, as you say, they were written for an ensemble of good people.
Do you think that some of the movies, or, you know, like South Pacific, for example, is very different than the original production is, the movie of South Pacific versus what's, does that sort of mess up the, you know, with the memory of these shows, where is, to me, like the visual of South Pacific is the movie that people might see right. If they want to learn about the show. Do some of these movies bother you, or do you like the movies that were made of the shows?
Well, the best movie of all the Rodgers and Hammerstein properties is, you know, let's face it, The Sound of Music.
Right.
And it's a bit of an anomaly because I think, you know, when a Broadway musical is adapted to films, you know, this phrase everybody uses of opening it up. And in the case of The Sound of Music, opening it up not only gave you these incredible vistas of mountains in Austria that are spectacular to look at, but it turns out that it suited itself to a movie. They made very, very clever changes in the movie, which are really good for the movie. They belong in the movie, not on stage. But that was kind of the best. Also, by that point, well, Hammerstein died before the movie was ever really contemplated. Rodgers wrote two new songs for it, but they'd been through the 50s where they were much more involved in some of the movies, like Oklahoma and South Pacific.
Right.
And I think they were smart enough guys to realize they weren't movie people. They were theater people. And those two movies, as you say, they're kind of straightforward documentations of these stage productions, but they're pretty stagey. And actually, the King and I is an interesting movie because it's actually not as good as you think it is.
I feel like I haven't seen it. I probably saw it when I was a little kid, yeah. But I haven't seen it in years. But
yeah, I mean, he's good. He's good and she's good. But the way the secondary characters are used in the movies, in a way that's very telling, because I think this part of what makes The Sound of Music work as a movie is they minimize those secondary characters, took out all the politics, took out, frankly, all the interest in Max and Elsa, and made Elsa right. just the other woman and Max a person who seems to be hanging around.
Right.
It's one of the revelations when people see the stage production of The Sound of Music, how robust those roles are and how full of politics they are. And it's like, wow, I didn't know that was in there. So in The King and I, they don't know what to do with Lunta and Tupton. They just don't know what to do. And so there's some terrible scene in the garden. They also cut some of their songs. But yeah, that's what happened.
But when you're familiarizing yourself with the material, I'm sure you already kind of know the material because it's just part of the culture. But are you kind of watching these movies? Are you finding documentation? Are you reading the scripts? How do you become an expert in the 9 shows that Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote?
One at a time. Just try to take everything in. The first summer I was there, I had actually never seen The Sound of Music on stage. So I did a little trip and went to see it at the St. Louis Muni. Yeah. A theater I'd never seen. I did see The King. I grew up in New York at a time where my first Oklahoma was at City Center, which had a whole spring season of musicals. My first King and I was at the what's called the Music Theater of Lincoln Center that was established when Lincoln Center began. And I just loved The King and I thought that was great. I also saw my first South Pacific as part of that series. And Carousel. Those three I saw as part of the Music Theater of Lincoln Center. So, you know, The Sound of Music, I figured I really should see this on stage.
Right.
But it was a combination of looking at whatever, you know, films were there, reading the scripts, listening to albums, a lot of albums of these shows, and some very funny sort of cover albums through the years. Ed Sullivan presents, you know, Carousel. There was a great Reprise Records, which was Frank Sinatra's record company, did these, I think there are 3 or 4 bizarre pop versions of musicals. And there's one of South Pacific with Sammy Davis Jr. singing You've Got to Be Carefully Taught, the McGuire sisters singing Dites-moi in English. It's bizarre, but fun. So I mean, also the other thing I did that was very helpful is just sort of open cabinet drawers and see what's there and pull stuff out. Because there were a lot of really, really fascinating stuff. And luckily, as my time at Rodgers and Hammerstein grew, I was able to bring people like Bruce Pomahack, who I had known before, into the fold as somebody who was incredibly knowledgeable about Rodgers and Hammerstein from having done the shows and being a composer and orchestrator, composer lyricist, mostly of industrial shows, which ask him to tell you about them. They were fun. I have a box in my garage of scores of some of his industrial shows. I sort of gathered people who were experts in slightly different ways, so that the accumulation, also a guy named Bert Fink, who is a press person, who had done a thesis in college on Rodgers and Hammerstein. So I was smart enough to gather people around me who really knew the stuff, so that, you know, we could actually, all of us, become very, very versed in these shows, what worked. I also, I've always said that if I don't learn something from a new production, there's something amiss. And I right. just continue to hear things, that make you realize how complex these shows actually are.
If you don't have, you know, amazing people around you or amazing resources to dive into these shows, but you really want to understand them. For me, like, I don't really understand Romeo and Juliet or Pipe Dream. And, you know, it's hard to find great materials to sort of dive into these shows. Any tips on how to understand these shows get what they are?
It's interesting. Pipe Dream is fascinating. And the one thing I was able to do with Pipe Dream is we were sort of waiting for encores to say, let's right. do Pipe Dream and or Me and Juliet. Although they did do Allegro the very first year of encores. Because in all the conversations about encores, everybody kept saying, you know, the kind of show that encore should do, they should do like Allegro. You know, it just kept coming up.
Let's just do it.
And so it's like, okay, let's put it in the first season. But when Rob Berman came around and said, I really would love to do Pipe Dream, and we had actually restored the score, which is another thing you should talk to Bruce about, because he did it absolutely brilliantly. They cast it really well and they did it really well. And so over a weekend, I did everything I could to get a live performance captured so that there's a CD. So if you want to know about Pipe Dream, there is a Ghostlight Records CD of the encore's Pipe Dream. It'll give you a very good reading of the score with people like Laura Osnes and Will Chase. And you know, so that you hear the Rodgers and Hammerstein-ness of Pipe Dream because it sounds like a Rodgers and Hammerstein
right.
show. Ultimately, I think the downfall of Pipe Dream is that it's about people that just were not of interest to Rodgers and Hammerstein, you know, the Kings and people who, you know, take care of children. And I mean, there are things that they really understood. I don't think they understood these lowlifes who just hang around and, you know, there's a whorehouse that they didn't understand.
Right.
I will say I was a Rodgers and Hammerstein for 40 years and I only saw Me and Juliet once. Encores was not remotely interested in it. I saw it at the York Theater in one of their musicals in Mufti. It's a really peculiar show. There's a recording of it. There's both Pipe Dream and Me and Juliet have scripts that were published when the shows were first out. And, you know, go to Book Finder and find them.
Read the scripts
and listen to the music and try to, and also, you know, it's interesting because, you know, every great artist that establishes him or herself or themselves, you know, they start, it's exciting. Then they do things that are exciting in different ways. And then they've established themselves as an entity or as an artist. And then there's always a period where people are a little bit like, oh yeah, we've seen that. We know what you can do. Let's get them. Mr. Sondheim, come in here. It's, you know, somebody new. You know, and I think they were subject to that in the 50s, which is also why The Sound of Music is remarkable in that in some ways it's a throwback, you know, almost to the world of operetta. But by that point, whatever the integrated musical means, everybody took it for granted, and it's very much part of The Sound of Music.
Right.
And it's, you know, to this day, it's the number one Rodgers and Hammerstein show.
For
the one everybody wants to do.
For historical purposes, is it worth diving into Me and Juliet?
Sure.
Yes. Okay.
Don't spend a lot of time on it.
Okay. Yeah. A little bit of time. Spend a little bit of time on it.
It's a backstage musical, and so it's supposed to be kind of, you know, funny and you know, I'm sure it's. I do remember somebody telling me that there's an overture with. It's a show within a show. So Me and Juliet is the show that they're all doing.
Right.
And the conduct there's an overture of the show within the show, and the conductor is like turning around and casing all the young boys in the orchestra and the audience, which apparently was a complete parody of one of the conductors of Broadway in those years that did that a lot, to do that.
You know? There's something in the show. When Ariana Grande records Seven Rings,
yes.
Does someone come to you about this? What? How does this come together?
Well, one of two things happens in a situation like that. Either somebody says up front, as Daniel Fish's crowd did at Bard, we'd like to do this production and it's a little weird, but we want to tell you what it is. That's one way to do it. The other way to do it is what Ariana Grande did, is record the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then say, can we get a license? And that was interesting because, you know, as my daughter said to me, she's one of the biggest pop stars around. And her diction is such that you probably won't hear the lyrics anyway. So, you know, sometimes I think what if the families had still owned the company, what would they have thought of Seven Rings? And, you know, it's one of those sort of apocryphal conversations. It doesn't mean anything. But the fact that it's now owned by a corporation that's primarily interested in exploiting stuff and making money, it was sort of a slam dunk. They were going to agree to it. There was no question.
Do you think that brings any awareness? Do you think any kids listen to that song and go, what is the, and sort of track down the rabbit hole and find the show? Or do you think it's too disconnected and it doesn't quite translate like that?
I think that one's too disconnected. There are some that have happened over the years that I think might make people fascinated. You know, if I were a rich girl and stuff like that, that might make people think, wait a minute, what is that? But I don't know. You know, Ariana Grande is this odd creature. And it was very, very, very popular, that song.
It's very popular.
Hey, thanks for tuning in. Hope you're enjoying this episode with Ted. Quick thing, just a little reminder. If you're a professional working in the country music industry, now is your time to renew your membership to the Academy of Country Music. We said it at the beginning and we're saying it again. Not a member yet, there's still time to join, but it closes October 15th. So get your application in now. Do what you gotta do. acmcountry.com/membership. That's acmcountry.com/membership. Again, guys, it's the ACMs. Come on. It's a no-brainer. You gotta do it. Do it right now. Pause. Now. Go. Okay, we're back. Here we go. More Ted.
Okay, well, we are here for the Anna Gaiorgun 75th anniversary. First of all, for people who might not know the story, how does Irving Berlin get the show? Because it's kind of an interesting time in his career.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how he gets the show, right? How does he get the show?
Yeah, and also if we're talking about Rodgers and Hammerstein, how do we talk about Irving Berlin when we're talking about Rodgers and Hammerstein?
Yeah.
Okay, very simply, when Rodgers and the Hammerstein got together and wrote Oklahoma, it was a far bigger hit than anybody anticipated.
Right.
And they were both still working with their other collaborators, but things were not going great in either one of those situations. So Richard Rodgers, Oscar Hammerstein, boom, clearly they were a good combination. And from the get-go, they decided to produce their own shows. And also, since they had a production office, they would produce other shows. Sort of, it took them, they wrote a new show and produced it every other year from 1943 pretty much to 1959. And in the off years, they would produce other shows, either right. plays or musicals. So allegedly, Dorothy Fields came to them and said, what do you think of Ethel Merman as Annie Oakley? And they said, we'll produce it. We don't want to write it, but we'll, because she was going to do it with Jerome Kern. So they said, we'll produce it. What a great idea. So Jerome Kern came east to start working on it and also to attend rehearsals of a revival of Showboat. And he had a cerebral hemorrhage on the street and died 3 days later. So Rodgers and Hammerstein producers faced with the fact, what are we going to do? And somebody says, Irving Berlin, wouldn't that be great? And they said, yeah, but he'll never do it. He's huge. He's actually bigger than we are. He's not going to do it. And then Hammerstein, I believe, said, before we decide he's not going to do it, let's ask him. So they asked him, and he was a little, you know, I don't really write those kind of things. You know, he had written shows, but he was more a songwriter. And allegedly, you know, they said, well, take the script, read it and see what happens. And 3 days later, he called and had three songs done. And they were pretty extraordinary. And actually, there's a story that I told Todd Purdom, because I think it's in his book. But when I got to Rodgers and Hammerstein, there was a man named John Fernley, who was the casting director for R&H. Elegant, elderly gentleman. And I have I should say, one of the things that I was able to do at Rodgers and Hammerstein when Irving Berlin died was to take on the management of the Irving Berlin catalog.
Right.
So now we were Rodgers and Hammerstein, who had produced Annie Get You Gone, and now we were also representing Irving Berlin. I, to your point, studied up on a lot of the Irving Berlin musicals that I didn't know, and I had lunch with John Fernley. And I said, John, you were around there. I just have to ask you, I'm looking at these other shows, and they're fun. You know, they have good things in them, but none of them hold a candle to Annie Get Your Gun. What happened? And he said, well, I'll tell you what happened. He said, Irving Berlin would write a song and come in and play it for Dick and Oscar and say, this is going to be great. The chord progression is very similar to White Christmas. I'm sure it's going to sell a lot. And he'd then play the song. And Dick and Oscar would say, Irving, that's a great, great song. But here's what we need. We need a song between Annie and Frank, you know, and they would just sort of steer Irving Berlin to write the song that's needed for the show. Because in some ways, I think the songs in Annie Get Your Gun, while they have a very distinctive personality of their own, which is Irving Berlin's, the thinking behind the songs is very much Rodgers and Hammerstein kind of character, you know, move the plot a little bit, tell us about the characters, that kind of stuff. So it was a great collaboration. And I think there was always jealousy between Irving Berlin and Richard Rodgers, especially. They not only buried the hatchet to do Annie Get Your Gun, but they both had a huge hit out of it. And right. At the end of the day, that's what everybody wants.
And then what's the story of Anything You Can Do where they're singing in the apartment and they're saying, we need another song Annie and Frank in the second act. And he writes it in the cab, right? Is that the story?
Yeah, they were talking, again, as anybody who has ever been involved with the creation of a new musical, you realize the more you get into it, the actually easier it is to figure out what the missing pieces are. So that at one point there was a conversation and they can't sing a love song because it's a sort of a battle love story between the two of them. Because they're very, very good at the same thing, although she's a little better than he is.
They're very competitive.
They're incredibly competitive. Yes. And so somebody said, what about a song that's a competition? And apparently Irving Berlin said, okay. And got in the cab and went home. And when he got home, he called Josh Logan and said, what about this? Anything you can do, I can do better. And Josh said, where'd you come up with that? And he said, In the cab.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. But it is, I mean, it's, you know, from the experiences that I've had, like working on Follies that I documented on the book, you know, when you now know who the performer is, you now know more about what the show is going to feel like, what the style is going to be. And you feel there's a little hole here or there's something there. And then talented people can go home and, you know, pull out a piece of paper or sit at the piano and focus on what that needs to be.
Right. Here's a kind of nerdy trivia question that I've always just wondered myself. In the movie, Annie Get Your Gun, it opens with the song Colonel Buffalo Bill, which is not in the show, if I'm not mistaken. It's not on the cast recording.
Well, it is in the show. It is in the show. It depends on which recording you're listening to. The first recording of Annie Get Your Gun, I grew up with this one my father made at Columbia Records with Doris Day and Robert Goulet. And it has Colonel Buffalo Bill. I'm pretty sure it has Colonel Buffalo Bill. I saw the production.
Is the Ethel Merman recording have it on it?
I don't think I've listened to that in a long time. The original
Spotify, because I was checking, it's not on the Spotify Ethel Merman recording of it.
Interesting.
But it was in the original show.
Yeah, oh no, it was in the original show. The two songs that were in the original show that are often cut are the two songs for the secondary characters, for Tommy and Winnie. I'll Share It All With You and Who Do You Love, I Hope. Again, they're secondary characters who, when Richard Rodgers produced the revival in 1966 with Ethel Merman, Irving Berlin wrote, We'll Have an Old-Fashioned Wedding. So that they cut the other songs, but, you know, gave this song. Created this new song, another one of his double songs, which he knew how to write.
And then all three of those were in the 1999 revival, right?
Yes, Peter Stone and Graziella, they figured out a way to use them all.
Okay, so the big question is, does the show hold up today? Could it be mounted today outside of Encores?
Yes, I think the answer is yes. I think the interesting viewpoint that has to be dealt with is whether Annie throws the competition at the end so he can get her a man, which right. is the way it is originally, to whether it gets motivated. So either, as I have seen, she, and I think this is the way Peter Stone did it, she like looks at him and figures, you know what, it is actually worth it. And so she blows it, not by using the gun that's been, but just by shooting it, I mean, way off guard. It's like, I'm not interested in even entering into this competition. For yeah. me, the choice is you. Or no, I think what Peter Stone did is it stopped just before the end. And it's like, and they lived happily ever after kind of thing. So I think, I mean, you know, directors have always had fun with that, but nobody today wants, you know, the girl to go, oh, you know, you're just too much of a hunky guy and I got to have you. So I'll toss off that which I'm really good at and in fact, and better than you at. That can't work. But I think, again, the relationship between the two is kind of fun because, you know, he can't deal with the fact that a woman is better at something than he is. And she just is sort of goo-goo-eyed. So, you know, there's an interesting story in there. I think a little judicious editing and perhaps shaping so that it isn't quite as obvious is good. And then they have those songs to sing, which, you know, at the end of the day in a musical, if you have those songs to sing, you're in good shape.
In the music industry, we talk about how if you want to be a career artist, you don't want the songs to be bigger than the artist. And it feels like with this show, the songs are almost bigger than the show. No Business Like Show Business feels bigger than Annie Get Your Gun. Mm-hmm. Do you think that overshadows it? Or do you think that somehow diminishes the memory of the actual show? Or does that, when the song is that big, does that keep putting a spotlight back on the show?
Well, it's an interesting point that you make about the artist and the song and which one overshadows, because I'm not sure that works in the musical theater quite the same way. I mean, in shows like Annie Get Your Gun that were written for a very, very particular performer, being Ethel Merman, you know, she introduced the songs and she had a very specific theatrical style, but she was not in any means a popular singer.
Right.
So people have been able to take these songs and there's been no problem in having the songs have a personality, even though her personality was bigger than I'll get at. In a show, if you're lucky to write a song like this, No Business Like Show Business, which becomes not only a kind of anthem for the traveling troupe of players in the show, but also becomes kind of an anthem for the show business and prompts certain people. I love the phrase, I wish the business there was no business like was more business like.
Wait, what does that mean? Say that okay. one more time.
Somebody said, I wish that the business that there's no business like is more business like.
Yes.
It's a twist and a turn that basically is about what the song is about. There, you know, there is no business like show business. And frankly, we will recoup when. And yes. and the charges for this are what, right. you know, and you're telling me how many people do I have to have in the orchestra? You know, I mean, there are all these things, especially in Broadway, that one might very well say, excuse me, you know, I don't want the house curtain, but I have to hire somebody to raise it and lower it every week. You know, right. That kind of stuff.
I always love the line, and lips together, teeth apart. There's no business like the show business.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
There's no business like the show There's business. No business. That has to be it. Right. Why did the family, and I guess you, decide to sell the R&H catalog when you guys did?
Yeah. It was not my choice. So I was a hired hand. However, I don't know the true answer to the question. Mary Rogers, who by that point had inherited the Rogers family role, you know, comparable to the Hammerstein family role. We were doing a sort of self-examination of the office at my urging, because I just thought, you know, we've been at this for a while. We're all dealing with instinct. And if things start to go a little soft or if something happens, we should be I wanted to prevent panic from setting in because I thought I could see the possibility of a panic and that would be bad for everybody. So I encouraged us to sort of take a look. Do we, you know, the way we're behaving, do the contracts actually support that? Or are there handshakes that were never actually consummated into writing? That's what that's what we were doing, and I thought would be very helpful. And I didn't have an end goal in mind. I thought maybe take on a partner of some kind who would bring something to the table. But Mary just woke up one day and said, we're selling. We're selling, and we're selling everything. Because what a lot of people don't understand is that not only were the businesses all sold, but the copyrights themselves were sold. Which I mean, I've had many a conversation where, you know, people who buy and sell publishing companies, it's like, no. Yes, the publishing company was sold, but actually the copyrights were sold as well. Right. And I think Mary was a dynamo, very opinionated. And I think she felt two things. I think it would be easier for the next generation to have cash to deal with, invest, and you're on your own. And also she felt that the Hammerstein family was more complicated, and that they had had some sort of leadership troubles to try to figure out who would be the voice for that generation. And I think she sensed Alice was alive. Alice was the last member of her generation who was alive. And when she went, the leadership by Oscar Hammerstein's will would fall to the next generation, oldest first. And I think she just said, that's not really a plan to run a business. And so, and she was determined. And so that's, and I was sort of watching it all happen, thinking, gee, this is going to, I don't know what's going to happen here. I don't know if they're going to want me to stay on. And you know, they slightly far down the conversation about selling it, I was told that I very much needed to be part of this, of the future. But I stayed on for 10 years under two ownerships, but still had more fun with the families, I would say.
Do you think that what would be happening with the shows would be different if it was still family held versus being a little more corporate held, or hard to say?
Well, again, right now, you know, being a couple of months after I stepped aside, even under the years when the Dutch owned us, we did the Cinderella that had never been done on Broadway before, and the Daniel Fish Oklahoma, which are, you know, and the Sound of Music Live on NBC.
Yeah.
So they happened sort of under the radar. I mean, I was doing my job and these things were coming up, and I was still doing what I always did. You know, Concord's now owned it for a couple of years. The Daniel Fish came to Broadway during the Concord years. But other than that, I don't know what the future is going to be. I mean, I'm hoping that there was a very good production of The Sound of Music that Jack O'Brien directed and toured the country. It was and had no star in it. It was just a really, really well directed and well put together production. And I'm hoping that that will have a future life, because it seems to me, frankly, after the Daniel Fish Oklahoma, the innovation of Jack O'Brien is completely the other end of the spectrum, by which I mean it is word for word the show that opened in 1959 on Broadway.
Right. I was going to ask also, with the Daniel Fish Oklahoma, when you see that show, the reaction does that make you want to push the envelope further with these shows?
No.
In fact, do you want to push it less because of that? Or
I view the Daniel Fish thing as a complete bubble.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, as I said earlier, they came to me and said, we are interested in doing this. And it's a communal event, I was told. We, you know,
there's chili.
Food is being cooked during the first act, and at the intermission, everybody's audience and actors alike share in a meal together. And I thought that's an idea. I don't know if it means anything. And so it, you know, they did it at Bard, and it was interesting. Then you know, there were talks about bringing it to New York, and then they brought it to St. Anne's. They didn't have Broadway rights when it came to St. Anne's, because it was one of those things where it's like, is this a good idea? Is this a good idea? Every step of the way. And then when the Circle in the Square became available and they said, we want to bring it in, it was like, okay, okay. And I think, I mean, from my standpoint, there were as many people who reached out to me and said, what an extraordinarily eye-opening, amazing thing. Terrence McNally said, this is why I fell in love with the theater. By which I don't think he was going to think this is the way Oklahoma has to be done all the time. But
why do you think he felt that way? What about the show?
Because what I think Daniel did was absolutely forced everybody to deal with the words, the music, the plot, the time. And if you had a preconceived notion of, you know, filigrees and, you know, that kind of stuff, you felt betrayed by that production. But if you were willing to go walk into a theater, and as Terrence McNally was a theater man to this end of his fingertips, just to see something that you had did not expect, but hear these lines that were both revealing and funny and all kinds. So I think that's what it was.
It did kind of do that in a different, like, I feel like you go to the theater a little bit to kind of have that warm and fuzzy feeling.
Right. Inside, no warm and fuzzy.
Which
no
is not what you get in that production of Oklahoma at all, but it does do something else for you. And just the fact that people were then talking about the show and debating it, that has to be good for the legacy.
Yeah, no, I mean, I will stand behind it. And it was when all is said and done, it was
a good experience.
I don't regret it, no. And the funny thing was, you know, Oklahoma opened before the Tony Awards were established. So the show had never won a Tony Award. Oh, so now it has a Tony Award.
That is a very interesting point. These shows are going to be in the public domain within the next 15, 20 years. I think Showboat's going in the public domain next year.
Showboat is the first one. And then there's a chunk of time.
When that does happen, is there going to be an integrity loss, do you think, that there's not going to be as many gatekeepers to who can put these shows on? What do you think that looks like?
There won't be gatekeepers.
There won't be any gatekeepers.
Because that's what the public domain means is that you can use those things as an interpretive artist in any way that you want. And I think there will be people who will, I mean, I have no idea, frankly. I have no idea how it's going. I mean, think about Showboat. That's kind of weird. And we're dealing with this in a little bit of a way is when you go into the details, what is going in the public domain in the United States it was 27, so it's 95. So yeah, it's next year. It's what was registered for copyright in 1927, which means the show that opened on Broadway in 1927. When John McGlynn did that recording and did all that cut material, all that stuff has a 1988 copyright registration.
Interesting.
So if you want to do Showboat in the public domain and not pay a royalty, you can't use any of that other or the movie songs. I mean, there are songs, that's one show that songs have been brought in and out and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So you don't actually have free reign to do whatever you want. You have a free reign to do what opened at the Ziegfeld Theater in 1927.
Interesting. Okay.
So I've said to a couple of people who are interested, let's work together. You know, don't play the game because I'd much
don't
rather
think you're going to get away with this.
Well, don't put yourself in a position where somebody has to come after you.
Yes. You know, okay. So. Okay. Couple rapid fire questions. One is there a question that you would have loved to have asked Rodgers and Hammerstein about a show, about something that you wish you could have been able to ask them?
The thing that comes to mind is tell me about An Ordinary Couple in The Sound of Music. It's the one song that the movie song Something Good fits very emotionally, I think, better than An Ordinary Couple. And I don't understand An Ordinary Couple. So I would say, tell me what this song is.
What were you thinking about in that song?
Okay. Well, it's one of those songs. They were very good at subtext. And the music does not tell you that they're ordinary at all. The story doesn't tell you that they're ordinary. So it's almost like the two of them having a moment of self-revelation saying we're an ordinary couple, but we're really not. So, right.
Okay. What do you think is the best Rodgers and Hammerstein show to do in a high school or a youth production?
Wow. Probably Oklahoma, only because it's about youth. I mean, it's the country is emerging, the people are, a lot of the characters are on that sort of, you know, young age, emerging, you know, any emerging, finding being a woman is. I mean, there's a lot of that in Oklahoma. And I would think that would be best for young folk to sort of glom onto.
Oklahoma, it's a classic. It's done everywhere. Are the King and Anna in love or are they just friends?
Well, see, that's my favorite. That's my favorite show.
That's your favorite show?
It's the first one I saw. And it was a beautiful production and I thought it was great.
Yeah.
I believe, yes, they are. I don't believe it's a love that ever could be or would be consummated. But I think one of the things I love about the wisdom of that show, because I think it's very wise, is these two people who are both of them incredibly headstrong, and stubborn, and they are forced by the nature of the situation to listen to the other, And I just think there's never a time in our lives where the idea of somebody saying, would you listen a little more and talk a little less? Thank you, Lynn. You know, it's a classic thing. And that's what I find fascinating about The King and I, because ultimately, you know, and Shall We Dance, how to make such an incredibly romantic moment out of a love that's not consummated with, of all things, a polka that makes no sense at all.
That makes no sense.
No sense at all. But the fireworks between these two people on so many levels, I find it incredibly appealing. So yes, I think they're in love, but never consummated.
Okay, fair enough. Coming out of COVID now, it feels like you want to be putting on shows that are full of joy or just very grand and you know, warm and fuzzy, which I think Rodgers and Hammerstein really accomplished. Yeah. Is this a good time for a revival of a Rodgers and Hammerstein show? I mean, there's been several kind of recently, but is this a good time to put one up right now?
Well, I think it's a good time for Jack's The Sound of Music.
Yeah.
Because to talk about warm and fuzzy, you know, most everybody has a warm and fuzzy feeling about The Sound of Music. Some people are sick of watching it on television and all that stuff, but ultimately it has a crowd base around the world too. What Jack did for this production, and frankly, what even lesser productions do, but Jack's really does, is it, if you only know the movie and you go into the show and it starts with her on top of a hill, singing The Sound of Music, check, right? You know, in a good production, she doesn't twirl, because that has to do with movies and a helicopter and figuring out how to take the, you know.
It doesn't look great on the stage.
It doesn't make any sense. Anyway, be that as it may. Then you go to the Mother Abbess, and then within 5 minutes, the Mother Abbess and Maria are singing My Favorite Things. So if you only know the movie, it's like, wait a minute, that's not here. That's supposed to be in the bedroom. So right away, people's curiosity is clicked, but you're never too far from something that's familiar. So in a funny way, the warm and fuzzy is there, but then there's something that, there are things that capture your imagination and your fancy. So you're drawn into the story in a better way. And the first thing that Jack O'Brien said to me about the show, because he had actually seen a dress rehearsal of a production in Moscow.
Interesting.
He went with Margot Lyon, who emailed me and said, you've got to get Jack O'Brien to tell you about the production that we saw. And what he said was, he said it wasn't very interesting, but he said there was unbelievable heat between Maria and the captain. And he said, I realized, you know, these are two people for whom a relationship is completely out of the question. She's going to be a nun. Clearly, he was devastated by the death of his first wife. They are neither one of them set up for a relationship. So yeah. When it happens, Jack said, it's amazing. It's extraordinary. So that's what sort of got him in. So anyway, and long-winded answer to your question, I think if we can figure out how to get Jack's production of The Sound of Music out and about, that's I think what audiences are going to want, because it's something familiar, but something that also, you know, sparks the imagination.
I think that would be amazing. I would love to see that.
Yeah.
Is there something in a Rodgers and Hammerstein show that has become commonplace over the years or has been added in for some reason that you think is a detriment to the show or that you wish wasn't?
Well, you know, people always like to put the two movie songs in The Sound of Music. Again, I Have Confidence is a great song for a movie because it's all about getting her physically from Nuremberg Abbey to the Von Trapp house. And it's the travelogue, you know, all through to Salzburg. She also has to change costumes before she sings that song. So I think it's a locks on stage. I don't buy the argument that, but the audience wants it because they know it in the movie. It's like, sorry, Andrew Lloyd Webber, I'm not interested. Although he did do it in his production. Does it ruin an evening of The Sound of Music? No, actually it doesn't. It's just kind of unnecessary. Something good, however, does fit. And actually, it's a little bit of a stretch, but you know, even though Jack's production is verbatim 59, Something Good does get slotted in there.
But in a perfect world for Ted, this song would not be included in the live production.
Probably. But he'd figure out Jack would figure out a way how to make an ordinary couple work.
Okay, fair enough. What have we left out here in our final moments? Have we left
anything? Are you kidding me? We could go on forever. I love your questions.
Okay, wait, so you stepped down recently.
Right.
What are you interested in doing now, and how involved are you going to remain?
Well, there are a couple of producing projects that are possibilities and more than possibilities. The Jack Sound of Music being one that I'd love to be in. I was one of the producers of it as well as being the licensor. And then there are some other, I'm doing another series of American songbooks at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center that I did a few years ago. So there are a lot of, it's a freelance world. It's something very new to me. I don't have an office to go to.
This is very exciting though. We can
It's great.
We can be doing anything. So, yeah. Well, it is Annie Get Your Guns 75th anniversary.
It is indeed.
If you want to understand this show, we were talking about this earlier. Do you watch the movie? Do you listen to the 1999 soundtrack? What is the best representation for this show?
I would think the movie is so of a period. I mean, it was supposed to be Judy Garland. It's not Judy Garland. It's Betty Hutton giving a performance that would be celebrated in any high school across America. I mean, it is big as all get out. It's a little too much of a muchness. I would say some recordings. The Bernadette Peters recording is very good for that production. The one, and I know it sounds peculiar, but the Robert Goulet Doris Day recording is very good. Real Freewald wrote a book in which about great recordings, and he dedicated an entire chapter to that recording. And then Ethel Merman. I mean, the 1966 production gives you full frontal Ethel Merman if you want that. So yeah, and I don't know. I don't think any script is published. I mean, certainly Concord, you can get it from Concord, but again, there are the original script is not available anywhere. The 66 is the one that people think of as the original. There's the Peter Stone version, and there may be more versions in the future.
Okay, fair enough. And so. And finally, do not change the overture of South Pacific, right? I've heard you talk a lot about this. Is that the best Rodgers and Hammerstein overture?
Yeah, I mean, the question of overtures is a big question these days because the shows are too long for modern audiences.
Yeah.
And an easy way to cut 5 minutes is to cut the overtures. They're there for a purpose. And also, they can be, you can make internal cuts. There are some clever ways that they can be cut internally. I would be much more of the make little cuts all the way through and in the show as well. If you cut the puzzlement reprise between Louis and Chula Longhorn in The King and I, you don't have to cast boys who can sing. And it's another couple of minutes out of the show, but it gives you something so wonderful. but that's what happens. The shows are so tight and they're so well constructed that you cut something and something's missing. But overall, if you do it smartly, you still get the oomph of the show.
You can still do it.
Yeah.
Do you think that more shows should have overtures today? Isn't the overture kind of going out of fashion?
Yeah, absolutely.
A little bit. Is that a bummer or the shows are ran without them so they make them work?
Well, it's a bit of a bummer, but I have to say 2 days ago, I saw the first performance of a Babes in Arms that Douglas Carter Bean has adapted. And he fell completely in love with the original production of Babes in Arms. And so he basically has this cast of 10 kids do sort of a swingle singers. The overture, the music for the overture is all there. It's just staged in a celebration of the music.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. Maybe he'll bring the overture back.
Did the Daniel Fish production have the overture in it?
No.
Was that a conversation or was that never in it to begin with?
I don't think it was ever in it to begin with.
I just remember they all walk out and then they sing.
Yeah.
Oh, a beautiful morning.
Yeah. No, because also the music wasn't the feature of that production. It was very, I think it was very well done and making it all bluegrassy style, but not sure you would want to hear those tunes in that style without seeing where it all fit and how it all fit together.
I'm curious to see it's coming to Nashville to TPAC, assuming it doesn't get canceled with COVID. I'm curious to see if they do it.
Me too. Me too. Well, I was supposed to have a conversation with Daniel just before the pandemic started.
Yeah.
Which would have been interesting, but I don't know. I don't know how that's going to play out.
I'm curious if they're going to leave the lights on also in these massive.
There are so many questions about.
So many questions. I'm not the only one. Yeah. Everybody's wondering.
and do you cut the ballet? Because, lot of people just cut it. Just, you don't need it. Just cut it.
What do you think? Do you cut?
I would cut it. I sort of struggled mightily with it. Again, my position, After Brooklyn, I just said, just take 5 minutes out of it. Because I figured, you know, one of the arts of the position that I had with Rodgers and Hammerstein was, you know, to let the artists do what they needed to do without saying, you know, you really, instead of the augmented seventh there, you might think of doing the, I mean, that Bruce can do that stuff. But I just felt, you know, trying to listen to what the artists are saying and what they want, without going into the weeds too much. But I just said, it feels too long. And I had the conversation where Daniel said, we've cut it. It's not 5 minutes that we've cut. We've cut 3 minutes, but this is what we want. And, you know, I said, okay. Cause I think ultimately, you know, but I think, I mean, the evening is long. And I think especially on a tour, the people who run those houses don't want an evening to be long. So I think there'll be pressure just not to do it.
Very interesting. Fantasy final question here. Do you think Rodgers and Hammerstein would have liked Hamilton and Lin-Manuel Miranda? Do you think they would have embraced that show?
I think they would have. I mean, I've said this before, and I think it's true. If they were alive, had been alive all through the transition of the musical theater to get to Hamilton, I think they would have loved it. If they were brought back from the dead and plopped down, I think they would have had some questions. You know, what is this rhythmy stuff that they're, you know, recitative? Like, that's opera. Didn't that go away? You know.
Fair enough. Ted, thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure. This is great.
We could have done five of these.
Well,
we'll have to have you back on at some point.
Anytime.
Hopefully we'll see you at a theater sometime soon.
Yes. Oh God, please.
All right. I'm trying to figure out what my first show back is going to be. My brother has tickets for Phantom opening night.
Okay.
Which I tried to get, but I couldn't get. I thought that would have been a fun one to see first. I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do. You know what you're going to see first?
Well, I saw Babes the other night.
You just saw that. You said
in Forestburg, New York, at the Forestburg Playhouse. And what was interesting is that there wasn't a great big deal made about the fact that a lot of us hadn't been in a theater in a year and a half.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. I mean, the audience all wore masks, but it was not till sort of afterwards I thought, oh my God,
that was crazy.
I just sat in a theater for a show. That's great.
I remember.
I'm seeing Passover. I'm seeing Passover next week because I'm a Tony voter, and I've taken my Tony tickets, and I don't want to go see Passover, which I saw at Lincoln Center. I like a lot. So
I'm excited to see it. Stay well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hopefully talk to you again.
Yes, indeed. My pleasure. Thanks for this.
There you have it. Episode 80. Ted on the podcast. Really fun talking with Ted. Thanks for taking the time to come on. Thanks for tuning in. The Zach Kuhn Show is mixed by Sam Heyman, and our theme music is by Justin Johnson. If you want more content from us, you can subscribe to our newsletter at NashvilleBriefing.com, or you can follow us on socials, everything at Nashville Briefing. The Zach Kuhn Show is part of the American Songwriter Podcast Network, and we're proud to be part of it. There's some great shows in this network. Check it out at AmericanSongwriter.com/American Songwriter Podcast Network. Easy enough. There you have it. That's it. That's all I got. ACMs. Don't forget to renew your membership. You can become a new member too. You can do it all. ACMs. Don't forget. And that's it. We'll see you next time. Bye.